Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, July 29th, 2021. And tonight's topic, a little extension of what I talked about last week. We're going to do a little physics problem here. And we're going to talk about Richard Branson going into space. Or you could, if you're a Jeff Bezos fan, that's equally the same. But the difference is, the big difference is Bezos went on a rocket. And Bert Rutan is the original designer. Richard Branson and his crew went on a jet liner, basically, had no liftoff, vertical liftoff type of thing. And so anyway, the first question I'm going to talk about is what, you know, once they took off and the rocket engine ignited and they went vertical upwards, what was it like? That's the first question. And then once the engine cut out, what are the dynamics? How far did they go? How long did it take them? What velocities did they reach, etc.? And this was what is considered a suborbital, in that it went up and it went back down. Although they did get up to what one would consider to be orbital distance. But now the difference is when they got up to the top of the arc of their trajectory, they were going 0 miles an hour. They literally stopped and then fell back down. So all of this time, they're weightless. They're unaware of their reaching the top of their trajectory and then coming back down. They're simply weightless this whole time. And the next thing they feel is when they're told to get back in their seats, strap into their seats. They're told to put their seatbelt on. And then what happens is these big fins on the spacecraft flip up. And when they start touching the atmosphere, when they start dropping down through the atmosphere, which is basically vacuum up at the top of their trajectory, once they start hitting the atmosphere, basically the spacecraft is pancaked. So it's coming flat down into the atmosphere, slowing down. And there's, I'll talk about the velocities that they're at. And the structure of the airplane is carbon fiber. Carbon fiber can handle tremendous heat. And so it does not have a coefficient of expansion with temperature. So what happens is the spacecraft really dimensionally doesn't change. And that's very important, because back in the old days, if this thing were made out of metal, you'd have things heating up and things stretching and at different rates. So you would have like the old X-plane series or the U-2 spy plane, or the what's the other one? The Blackbird, I think it's called, which is the high altitude, real high velocity jet plane used for reconnaissance, also, and for a spy plane, etc. But what happens with those? They're made out of metal, and when the metal expands, then they would pop the rivets out of the plane. So when the plane takes off, the rivets are loose. In the wings, they're rattling. They're rattling in the wing, and as the plane becomes hotter and hotter, the metal swells up and makes a tight fit. So you don't have any of that with carbon fiber. That's the beautiful thing about carbon fiber. And I have been around the carbon fiber industry for a long time. Back in the 90s, I had a business. It was an archery business. And I was making archery equipment, just like not exactly regular archery equipment. I was making vintage Middle Ages Old English archery equipment and other archery equipment. But then I got some funding, and I turned it into, took a couple of the designs and had them made in carbon fiber. Amazing, amazing archery equipment, but at the time it was so advanced for the industry, but it was literally the first carbon fiber bow on the market, any place that anybody had built, and they were long bows, not modern, what would you call it, with wheels and pulleys. composite, they're called bows. I don't call them a bow, they're a device. But anyway, so I have some background in carbon fiber, and also I've been around the aerospace industry watching that industry grow using carbon fiber. And Bert Rutan was one of the pioneers in this field using carbon fiber to make airplanes. And of course, he made his the Long Easy and a whole long list of other planes, canard type, where the little short wing out in the front provided a very stable aircraft, and also very much like a glider. So the canard design had been known about, but anyway, he perfected it and brought it to market. And that was the basis also for his Spaceship One, which won the Ansari X Prize. Okay, so let me tell you what I'm going to talk about here. There's some basic equations here. They're just basic physics equations, and it looks like this. You could imagine that the Earth, you're a certain distance above the Earth, and pretty much within this region, the gravitational field of Earth is pretty much a constant. Of course, as you go farther and farther away, the gravitational field of the Earth gets less and less. It's a 1 over r squared factor, but you can kind of ignore that when you're this close to the Earth. If you wanted to do the physics problem in a more advanced level, then you could take into account that little g, the force of gravity, is changing slightly. It's a little bit less as you go up, but as I say, for a basic problem and just getting some understanding, you can leave it as a constant. So we have a physics equation, v is equal to little g times t. That means that the velocity, if you are under acceleration of gravity, velocity is related to time by that simple equation, and distance is equal to 1/2 gt squared. And so these are just basic equations. Now, you can also solve for t by turning that equation around in terms of distance. And so you just do a little algebra there and solve for t, and you have time as the variable, the dependent variable, and then a small equation that relates it to the distance traveled. So we're going to go through these, but I'm not going to do these. Anybody not familiar with equations, that's okay. I'm just going to give you results here. And if you are a physics student, or if you're familiar with physics, then you can trace my steps and get the same answers that I got. So anyways, what happens, let's go through the whole liftoff routine again here. This Richard Branson and crew take off in equivalent of a jetliner, 4 jet engines that take them up to 45,000 feet. Now, how high up is that? And let's just give our standard here that 60 miles up is the edge of space. So 5,000 feet is a mile. So 60 miles is going to be about 300,000 feet up in the air. And so anyway, that's just to give you an idea, because we're going to be talking about feet and miles. Now, we could also convert this into meters and kilometers per second, etc. But most people that are listening to this show, at least in the United States, are familiar with miles per hour, et cetera, and feet per second, things like that. Another thing I'm going to define here is speed of sound, and that requires a little bit of discussion also. When you're at ground level, sea level, not ground level necessarily, but at sea level, the speed of sound is around 1,100 feet per second. That's around 700 miles per hour. And I'm going to be giving round numbers. So if somebody says, oh, that's not quite right, no. I'm just giving round numbers. Because sometimes it drives me crazy when people give you a number. It'd be, 4,573,421.7773. And it's like, why don't you just round it off and say, a number that's close to it. So I'll be using rounded off numbers. So once again, Mach 1, and once again, when they say Mach 1, that's a term that is about the speed of sound, and there's some small differences. But for this purpose, for this discussion, we're going to just say that Mach 1 is equal to 1,100 feet per second, which is the same as 700 miles per hour. So if you're going Mach 2, that would be twice those numbers, or Mach 3 would be three times those numbers. But here's the issue. These guys, when they start kicking it in with the rocket engine and go vertical upwards, they're not at sea level. But the terminology still applies. Even though the speed of sound is very different when you're up at 45,000 feet, or if you're up at 100,000 or 200,000 feet, the speed of sound literally, if you measured the speed of sound, it would be different. They use the speed of sound in Mach 1, etc., as a measure of speed, just kind of like to give, you know, so you're not talking about larger numbers, you know, Mach 1, 2, or 3. It's just kind of like in astronomy when they're talking about the, say, light years. It wouldn't make a lot of sense to talk about things in astronomy in terms of, or say, astronomical units. The astronomical unit is the distance between the sun and Earth. So it's common to talk about the distance to the other planets in terms of astronomical units, knowing kind of how far we are away from the sun. And so, you know, Mars would be so many astronomical units, or Jupiter, or planets closer to the sun would be a fraction of an astronomical union. It's just convenient to use these larger, or like light years, you know, the closest star being, what, something like 4 light years away, something like that. You know, so it's better than using, say, meters, in which you're just going to have this enormously big number with a lot of zeros, and it doesn't have that much meaning. So it's kind of putting things into perspective with different measurement units. And that's the same as with speed of sound. So when you're talking about spacecraft going fast, at least at this rate, and then, by the way, at the end of this discussion, I'll be talking about orbital velocity and what's the difference between what Branson did and orbital velocity, which apparently Elon Musk has a flight coming up soon in which he's going to take people, passengers, civilians around the Earth in orbit. So he'll be the first private guy to go into orbit, because Bezos and Branson did suborbital flights where they just went up and came back down. But that's a good start. I mean, that's, you know, you have to crawl before you walk, before you run, before you get in the car and drive 60 miles an hour down the road. You have to do things in succession. Okay. So anyway, just to clarify, when you talk about Mach 1, that's the speed of sound, or the equivalent of speed of sound at sea level. And so just to give you an idea, they got up to about Mach 3, is my understanding, with the rocket burn, and then the rocket cut out, and then they were in free fall. It's called free fall, even though they're going up. And then when they hit the pinnacle of their trajectory, then they start falling back down, and they are in free fall once again. And that's when they're gravitationless. That's when they're having a good time bumping around in the cabin and doing flips and things like that. And so anyway, they get up to about Mach 3, or around 3,300 feet per second, or around 2,000 miles per hour. And there again, I'm rounding off these numbers just to make them easy to kind of get a handle on. Okay, so let's follow the ride here. They take off from the runway. They're going, these are jet airplanes, so they're slowly climbing. It takes them quite a bit of time, a lot longer. They're climbing at a lower rate than, say, a jet airplane. A jet airplane, you take off at the airport. As soon as that nose of that airplane lifts up, you're going up and up, and within 10 minutes, you're at cruising altitude, or maybe less than 10 minutes, you're at cruising altitude, which might be around 32,000 feet. That's typical cruising altitude for normal flights. If you're doing long international flights, you might get up to 40,000 feet, but they're typically under 40, around 35,000 feet. That gives you an idea. And now also converting that to miles, how many miles up are you? I use just 5,000 feet per mile as a round number. There are more feet in a mile than that, a little bit more, but it's very close. And so if you're, say, 35,000 feet up, you just divide that by 5,000, and you end up with 7 miles up. You're 7 miles up above the surface of the Earth. Well, orbital distance is, or out of the Earth's atmosphere, or the edge of space, is considered 60 miles up. So at 35,000 feet in an airplane, jetliner, and you've gone your trip, you're at about 7 miles up. Branson went up to 45,000 feet, so that's 9 miles up. Okay, so they're 9 miles up. And the reason for doing this is because it's a very inexpensive way to get up to that level. Let me compare it to a rocket. So like take any of the rockets you see taking off. They're big and they're heavy and they take off kind of slowly. They go straight up, straight against the Earth's gravitational field. And by the time they get up to the 45,000 foot level, they have expended probably more than 50% of the fuel on the rocket. Now compare that to the amount of fuel that's used by Branson. It's clearly that lift vehicle for Branson did not have a rocket full of fuel because they're using the lift advantage of the wings. And so that's smart. That's smart. You're using a lot less fuel to get up to that level. And then the carrier vehicle drops off the rocket plane, which is going to go up into outer space. And it's much lighter. It has much less forces on it. So it has the whole structure can be much less much less structure in this thing. So the whole spacecraft can be extremely light. Okay. Anyway, just a few things about construction. So I've always been an avid proponent of runway to orbit technology. In fact, if you look on my webpage, jmccsci.com, I have a space hotel launch system that I've devised, and maybe someday it will be a working model for going into space and building space hotels. Anyway, you can go see that. I'm not going to talk about that now. But it uses the same principle of runway. You take it up to 50,000 feet. But with mine, I would take it up also with the carrier vehicle, which is very lightweight. I would take it up much higher, probably to maybe 60 or 80 or even 100,000 feet using cryogenic technology, and that would be reusable also. Where the jet engines take it up to, say, 45,000 feet, that's where they kind of have their atmospheric limit because there's not as much oxygen up there. And then you kick in the cryogenic engines, which are traditional fuel, kerosene and liquid oxygen, etc. And then the carrier vehicle takes it up. But the whole purpose of mine is that I don't want a big part of the hotel tube taken up by a rocket engine. And so I want it up there pretty high, and I want it going downstream because mine is going to go into orbit. Okay, so that's a different animal. So let me that's kind of an aside note. Because what Branson is doing is simply going up. He's not going horizontal. Now, just to give you an idea, jump ahead a little bit. If Branson, at the very top of his trajectory, were to want to go into orbit, they would have to then have a thruster that pushes them sideways of their current path because they're going straight up and down. And they would have to accelerate their spacecraft from zero to 17,000 miles per hour. So that's to get it into orbit. And so, of course, you don't go straight up and then horizontal. And that's the fallacy, by the way, of putting things into orbit that are on one of the fallacies of something called the space elevator, where they say they're going to put a cord up and a big weight out there, and then you ride up and down this cord. The big problem with that is that it doesn't work. And also, you would be discharging the vertical electric field royally, and this thing would be a disaster. It's not going to work. Anyway, and then you also have the issue that as it goes up and goes into orbit, there's a force backwards on it in the backwards direction. So you have to also carry fuel to make this thing maintain a vertical path. It's somewhat of a complicated concept. But people who are proponents of the space elevator have been watching too many maybe Flash Gordon movies. Anyway, okay, back to the Branson flight. So anyway, they go up with their jet carrier plane to 45,000 feet, pull the lever, the space rocket ship drops down, fires the rocket, goes ahead so they don't collide with the other ship, and then they just turn vertical upwards and go. So their burn is, it was like a couple minutes. But here's the primary fact that you want to remember. They're going to be going around Mach 3. Now, I'm not pretending that this is exactly what they did, but these are very round numbers that are going to give you an idea. Okay, so they go up, and where do they actually cut off? And so what I'm estimating is that they are actually at about, they could be as low as about maybe 40 miles of the 60 miles where the engine cuts out. And then they drift into suborbital space, into the beyond the 60-mile mark, and then fall back down. So they don't have to go up with the rocket engine. They can go about 20 miles short, potentially cut the rocket engine, go up on a drift path out of the 60 miles just barely, and then fall back down into the atmosphere. So using our equations that I talked about at the beginning of the show, here are some fun facts. This is off of a table that I made. And here's, for example, after 10 seconds, let's go up to the top of the trajectory, and then I'll do this backwards on the way up. Okay, so let's say they get up to the top of their trajectory, and then they start falling down. After 10 seconds of free fall from their zero velocity at the top of the trajectory, falling down 10 seconds, they go a distance of a quarter mile. Not very far. Only a quarter mile, and the velocity at the end of that quarter mile after 10 seconds of free fall is 219 miles per hour. Now, after 20 seconds, they have a distance that they've covered of 1.25 miles. And so this is part of the acceleration, that as they continue, they're going more and more and more. They're going faster and faster. That's part of acceleration. And so most people are familiar with accelerating in a car. You start at a stop sign, you put on the gas, you go away from the stop sign, and you accelerate up to a certain velocity. Kind of the same thing here. But this is under the force of gravity. And so at the end of that 20 seconds, they're going 438 miles an hour. So just to put that into perspective, your average jetliner is probably going around 550 to 600 miles an hour when they're up at cruising altitude. So right now, this spacecraft is still not going very fast relative to, moving things in the air. Okay, so after 30 seconds, they've gone 2.5 miles, only 2.5 miles. And now they're going at around 650 miles per hour. After 40 seconds, they've gone 5 miles, and they're going about 900 miles per hour. And after a minute, 60 seconds, they've gone 10 miles, and they're going at about 1,300 miles per hour, which is about Mach 1. This is free fall. This is without any interaction with atmosphere. And then after 2 minutes, if they continued to fall, they would have gone 43 miles, which is two-thirds the way back down to the ground, and they'd be going 2,600 miles an hour. So this is very interesting, because some people have questioned, well, how could they come back in the atmosphere? Wouldn't they burn up, or wouldn't, whatever? They're really not going that fast. Even with this free fall, they're going pretty slow. And the thing that a lot of people are used to is a space shuttle coming into the atmosphere, or maybe a meteorite, and they see it burning up, you know, et cetera. Those are coming in at really high velocity. The orbital speeds, and I'll be getting to this at the end of the show when I talk about orbital dynamics. The orbital speed for low Earth orbit is around 17,000 miles per hour. So that's a whole different ballgame. Now, if you're coming into the atmosphere at 17,000 miles an hour, you have to expend all of the kinetic energy of that, which is energy of motion. You have to expend all of that energy by friction with the atmosphere. And so that's a whole different thing, but there are ways to do that also. The problem with the space shuttle is it's really, really, really heavy. It's a very heavy piece of machinery, and that's one of the problems at takeoff also. You have this extremely heavy piece of machinery that goes up into orbit and then comes back down. And the Russians scrapped their space shuttle. They had a space shuttle before the United States had a space shuttle. I don't know if most people know about that. And it was a functioning, working space shuttle. And they stopped doing it. They said, this is crazy. And even to today, the Russians use heavy lift rockets to send their payloads into space. They've never gone with the idea of runway to launch because here's the reason why. Because they're lifting up very heavy payloads. We're talking 100, 200,000 pounds of stuff. And so their launches, and they're launching every day. You don't hear about this in the Western press. And they have been launching. They had a little mini shuttle called the Kronos. The Cosmos with a K. Of course, it's Russian. And so they had thousands of manned flights while we were all waiting around for the Gemini project and the Apollo project and all of that, the Mercury project. The Russians were going into space, into orbit, daily. They had so much lift power, and they're using the same rockets today. They're kerosene-based, and they have a couple launch centers out in the center of Russia, and that's where they come back in. They do not land in the ocean. They land their returning vehicles on land with big parachutes, and but anyway, they are using heavy lift rockets. And the place where runway to orbit starts to break down is when you have really, really heavy payloads, when we're talking a few hundred thousand pounds. And with my hotel system, for example, everything is very lightweight. It's carbon composite and, extremely lightweight payloads that are functionally already, they're going to be ready to assemble when they get up in space, ready to be occupied. In fact, you could send them up there with people in them. But that would add a lot of extra weight. And so it's better to send up the tubes with an automated system and then send the passengers up later. That's a different launch technique or philosophy. Okay, so anyway, once again, going through this. Now, let's go through this backwards. So if Branson went up to 40, let's say about, of the 60 miles, they went up to about, let's see, they're starting off at 9 miles at 45,000 feet. They're starting off at 9 miles up. If they went up to about, let's just say they went up to 20 miles, the atmosphere is very thin up there, and they could then cut the rocket engine, and they, if they were going at Mach 3, they could go up and literally drift out of the atmosphere 60 miles up and then come back down. And that's probably about what they did. They probably, people get the idea that this rocket plane, the rocket burn took them up to 60 miles. No. They probably cut out at maybe 30 miles up or 40 miles up at most when the rocket engine cut out, because they're pretty much out of the atmosphere, the thick part of the atmosphere. There's not much atmosphere, so not much drag. Then, according to this problem and going backwards at Mach 3, they would then go up another potentially 40 miles out into space and then come back down. So That's very telling. That's very telling. So the idea that they would come back in and burn up. The other thing is that when they're entering the Earth's atmosphere, they're slowing down. So they probably never, ever get to Mach 3 coming back down before they bring the big tail back and go into glider mode, where the instead of dropping straight down like a pancake, the spacecraft starts to move forward, and then it flies back and lands on the runway as a glider. And so that's kind of a trick, too. If you're a glider pilot with no power, you better know what you're doing. And the pilots they had on that aircraft were seasoned. I mean, these guys' credentials, they had flown every military plane. They had been in outer space. These are Navy pilots. And I'm not sure if they were Navy or Air Force or whatever, but these guys were seasoned pilots. They knew what they were doing. So when they brought that thing in, gliding in for a landing, they knew exactly what to do, how to time it, what the angle of approach, and they could drop and lower the nose, slow the craft down. So when they came in, they had all the correct velocity, to land directly on the runway. And if you saw the runway, they stopped very quickly. It didn't take them long to stop at all. But amazing, and all of this is pre-planned, of course. So they had many flights to understand the spacecraft, to understand its properties, etc. Okay, well, let me just kind of review then what they did. And this is part of also the walk before you run, crawl before you walk type of philosophy. Now they're ready to start doing more advanced flights, but their goal is just to give somebody a couple hour joyride with beautiful scenery. They got their own spaceport. They take off. I don't know what they're going to charge people to go up into outer space, but and they're going to do experiments, microgravity experiments, and things like that can last a few minutes. But it's a start. It's a start, and it's a great start, because now if you start putting people in orbit, that's a whole different ball game. If you start having space stations and hotels, it's a whole different ball game. This, a few-hour joyride where about 20 minutes of it is going vertically upward with a few minutes of weightlessness, and I don't know how long the actual weightlessness lasted, but it was under a couple minutes. But people will pay to do that and then get their astronauts' wings and, go back to work the next week, Monday morning or whatever. So a great business, and they've got a number of these vehicles built. And the rocket engines are standard. They've standardized all of their production and everything. I think they've put together an amazing technology. So my hat's off to these people for pushing forward, and it's something, I'll tell you this too, it's something that NASA never did. They wanted to charge people, millions of dollars to go up to the International Space Station, and I figured it out one time that to pay NASA's bill, their $20 billion a year bill, their ticket to ride, It would have taken hundreds and hundreds of rocket launches per year, and they can't even get one off. And so, anyway, yeah, they're something that NASA, because of its size, etc., couldn't do. But these people, with the right engineers and technology and pilots and staff, etc., did it for a much lower, more reasonable cost, and actually accomplished getting people into space. And so that's Branson's technology, is to get people into space. I think he's got some launch contracts, too, with the government, but it's a different system where they go up and they launch microsatellites. They're little satellites that have a specific task, and he can launch a bunch of them at one time, but there they take a rocket, basically, and drop it off from the carrier vehicle. It goes up into space and puts some things into orbit. That he can sell that service to the government for putting microsatellites. And who knows, there must be tens of thousands of microsatellites up there Maybe you have one following you around? Part of the government's spy program to spy on everybody. Anyway, once again, just understanding that when Branson and his team went up into space, the carrier vehicle goes up to 45,000 feet. That's 9 miles up. That's just part of the way up to the 60 miles that they wanted to get completely. The rocket plane drops off, goes vertical, and burns for a couple minutes, gets them up to Mach 3. And they never really talked about how high they were, but my guess is that they were no more than about 40 miles up when they cut that engine. They're out of the thick part of the atmosphere. There's very faint atmosphere. Now the velocity, they're going at about Mach 3 or 3,300. They're about 2,000 miles per hour. They drift up, stop, start falling back down for maybe a minute, something like that. The fins are up on the spacecraft, which makes the spacecraft pancake and do aerobraking, basically. And then when they start getting enough velocity and they're getting into the thicker part of the atmosphere, they bring the tails back. It turns into a glider. They glide back down and land. And so those are the parameters. They're never going more than Mach 3. And in a carbon-based spacecraft up at high altitude, it's not a big deal. Anyway, that hopefully that gives you an idea of the dynamics of what they did. Okay, so now let me turn over and talk about orbital speeds. Like I said, if Branson wanted to go into orbit when they got up to the very top of their trajectory, they were going 0 miles an hour. 0 miles an hour laterally, 0 miles an hour vertically. They were zero relative to the Earth. And so they get up there, and then they start falling straight back down. If he wanted to go into orbit, he would then have to fire a rocket and go laterally and take them from zero up to 17,000 miles per hour to get them into orbit. And in doing that, they would start falling, because only when you get up to 17,000 miles an hour would you be able to stay into orbit. And so anyway, the technique for going into orbit, now most of you have seen this, maybe you didn't realize it at the time, but when you're going into orbit, you see the rocket take off, and then it leans over after it gets up through the thick part of the atmosphere. That's generally vertical, just to get you out of the thick part of the atmosphere. And then the rocket kind of leans back into the direction of orbit, and it starts producing lateral velocity, which will add to its orbital velocity. Now, here's another thing. You always find these launch centers, like in Florida. They've talked about putting one at the southern tip of Hawaii because it's closer to the equator. And here's the reason. Because if you're at the equator and the Earth is spinning around, it's spinning around at one revolution per 24 hours, and the circumference of the Earth is around 24,000 miles, that's about 1,000 miles per hour. These are approximate numbers, of course. So at the equator, you're getting a boost of 1,000 miles an hour. You have to get up to 17,000. If you already have 1,000 miles per hour because of the rotation of the Earth, that's helpful. And so that's why the launches typically take place, you know, there. The Russians don't have that problem because their heavy lift rockets are so powerful that, you know, they can launch in any direction they want and get into orbit around the Earth. It's not an issue for them. But typical smaller launches in the space station, which is one of the targets for the reaching the space station. By the way, I think SpaceX has had 3 failures of taking materials to the space station in the last couple months. And they've had 3 failures, you know. And I suppose if you're up, if you're a guy on the space station, or woman, excuse me, a guy, whatever, all of a sudden the supplies don't come in, that could be a problem. And hopefully they got enough stuff up there so they can eat and do all the stuff they do. But, yeah, having three supply missions fail in a short period of time is probably a little disconcerting, not only for the people that lost the money financially on the ground, but the people up there who need this stuff to survive. Okay. So anyway, to go into orbit, then, you have to have that lateral velocity. And it's a lot. I mean, you can see that to get up just to low Earth into space, you only have to be going like Mach 3, around 2,000 miles an hour. To get into orbit, you have to be going 17,000 miles an hour. You have to accelerate this craft. And now if you're talking about a big craft like the space shuttle, 100, 200,000 pounds of stuff being launched, or a big, heavy, in orbital package of some kind of satellite or supplies for the International Space Station or something, that's a lot of weight to get moving at 17,000 miles an hour. So what Wernher von Braun figured out back in the probably the 40s, he was very well versed at this, that the way to do this was with a multi-stage rocket. You have the first stage, which is the heavy lift part. That gets you up to maybe 10 miles up in the air, not very far, about 50,000 feet. And then that burns out, and then you have the second stage, which takes it up and pretty much all the way into orbit. And then you have the final stage, which does the final burn and puts it into the final steps of orbit. And like I say, up to 17,000 miles an hour. And so now you have the issue of docking. And this is, by the way, what the Gemini project was all about. In the United States progress in terms of the early space program, they had the Mercury program, and that was simply to send a guy up into orbit, go around the Earth, come back down in to the atmosphere, and land in the ocean and pick him up. It's just a proof of concept. And so that was the Mercury program. The Gemini program was key because the Gemini is the twins. If you look at astrology and you talk about the Gemini, mythological zone in the sky, the Gemini, they're the twins. And so the Gemini program was named because you need two spacecraft that have to learn how to dock. And so the docking mechanism, etc., very important, how to lock these things together, form an airtight airlock, and then have people crawl through from one to the other, and then be able to ship materials through, etc. Okay, so that was the Gemini program. Then the Apollo program was to land a man on the moon. But the Gemini program was very important because the physical process of having two spacecraft meet up, lock together, form an airlock, and then transfer people and goods is extremely difficult. Now, just a caveat here, the Chinese were very late in entering the space race. And what they did is they, of course, needed to develop all this technology also. Well, it turns out that Russia was having financially difficult times at the time when China was entering the space race. So China just went over and bought all this technology from Russia, which was, I would dare say, primitive by American standards, but in a sense better. The Russians had a philosophy that once something worked in outer space, in airlock, in air tank, a valve, whatever it was, then they continued to use it, and they made many of them. Also, multiple redundancy. In the United States, we will build one big air tank for the astronauts, for example. And the Russians would make many little tanks. So that with the United States, you would push a button to activate a valve to open up the air tanks. With the Russians, they reached up and turned the valve. Much simpler, much less prone to failure, and also much easier to mass produce. And so the Russians still are using technology that was around in the 1950s, invented for the space program, very reliable. And also the thing is that as you make things bigger and bigger, there's more propensity to fail. It's just the way things are. So when things get bigger, because of their size and complexity and the stresses and things like that. They're just more difficult to make and have successful for long periods of time, whereas the smaller things tend to be more reliable. So if you may, and also you have the issue of redundancy in this, if you, when you have a lot of small systems, let's just take air tanks, for example. If you have 100 small air tanks instead of one big one, if one of those tanks fails, you've lost a 100th of your system. Not a big deal. If you have one big tank and something fails, and it, then you just lost all your service, your air, whatever, liquid, whatever it was. So there's a method to the madness. There's an old joke that NASA paid millions of dollars for a contract for a pen that would write in outer space, because your ballpoint pen uses gravity to pull the ink down in the little tube to get to the ball, and then the ball rolls around on the piece of paper and distributes the ink. That's the way a ballpoint pen works, but it requires gravity. And so anyway, NASA paid, you know, millions of dollars for people to come up with pens that would write in outer space where you have zero gravity. The Russians used a pencil. That's kind of a joke, but it's reality. The Russians always had something very simple that they did. And just an example of how the Russians used very simple technology. And the United States tend to make everything very complex and very large and with very little redundancy. Okay, so now you're coming off of your orbit. You're going 17,000 miles an hour. You want to come back into the atmosphere. You have to get rid of all of this kinetic energy. It's not like Richard Branson coming from a zero velocity, only getting up to maybe not even Mach 3 coming into the atmosphere before it turns into a glider and they just turn the nose up and very slowly drift back down to Earth and land. Coming in at orbital velocities, you have, like 8 times the amount of energy you have to expend. And what does that mean? That means 8 times the heating, 8 times the energy turning into, literally turning into heat. And so your spacecraft has to be built a lot different. You need a heat shield. And I would imagine with, for example, the Branson spacecraft, they could do that, but then you have a lot of stress. You have a lot of heat. You have a lot of heat dissipation and things. Now, what they found out on the, the Gemini and the Apollo programs is they would put a heat shield that would literally burn away as it came in. And so it was thick enough so that when it came into the atmosphere, it was burning away. And finally, it would slow down enough that the heat shield did not completely burn off before they opened up parachutes and brought it back down to Earth at a lower velocity. Okay, I'm going to switch gears here a little bit. Now, this past week, there's a page I've been somewhat critical of because they were not posting my posts. I don't do blogs very much, but I did on this page. It's called What's Up With That. It's kind of a play on words. It's WATTS, What's Up With That. And so anyway, they slam alternative energy. That's their main dialogue on this. And they have articles daily that are posted there. There's a lot of work there. But what occurred to me, being in the industry and knowing how disinformation works, that this was a disinformation page probably funded by General Electric and Siemens. And the whole point was to slam 3-blade wind turbines and solar and tell you how they don't work. And then all of a sudden they come along and say, well, doggone it, we got to really get back to that good old central power company power of GE and Siemens. So I keep pounding on this and posting, and they did post my posts this time, but I'm going to read them to you, my audience. Now, this is just the other day, so it's July 25th, and the article was about Ohio passing a law that would allow local municipalities to stop or prevent or not be forced into accepting wind projects that are, say, okayed at the federal level or at the state level or whatever. It's a law passed to allow local municipalities or counties to reject wind projects based on citizen input. So it's coming full circle here. And of course, this is my attitude is that this is exactly what they want. They want to prevent anything that actually works. So anyway, here's my comment that I think is self-explanatory. So this is from July 25th, just a couple days ago. And here's my comment. The plan is working exactly as designed. Flood the market with expensive blank, excuse my French, flood the market with expensive blank that does not work, then pass laws protecting the citizens, effectively preventing things that do work. The plan designed by GE and Siemens over two decades ago. And who are the real winners and losers? Winners, GE and Siemens, whose core business is Central Power Company Power, who flooded the market when and pushed green and alternative wind turbines that they knew did not work. End result, everybody clamoring against their green alternative crap. And the losers, the public, which has never seen the real alternative solutions and who will be forced to purchase Central Power Company electricity forever with the vague memory of the failed alternative energy industry. That was my first comment. And then there were some other sub-comments after that. And then the next day, I posted the following. Look who sits on the boards of AWEA, American Wind Energy Association, and CWEA, Canadian Wind Energy Association, GE and Siemens. To affect government policy, politicians, internet and news media bias, prevent opposing views from surfacing, why do you never see Canadian citizen groups' anger over their situation? Subsidies, Green New Deals, this blog is not long enough to list all of them, and the kickbacks that go with it. Siemens and GE were both caught and are facing criminal investigation in dozens of countries, oddly enough, except the USA and Canada, for bribing officials to push through the wind energy proposals, pushing through systems that they know do not work, suck up all the alternative money, and suck the taxpayers dry until the poor saps finally figure out that none of this crap works. And then GE and Siemens proclaim through a well-orchestrated propaganda campaign via Michael Moore and many others that alternative energy does not work. So doggone it, we have to get back to that good old reliable Central Power Company brought to you by GE and Siemens core business. The one thing that is missing, there are real alternative solutions that most people will never see or hear of. This was all part of the plan. It's working exactly as planned. Okay, well, you can see my attitude a little bit coarse, but on point. This is exactly what was going on when I wrote my book, The McCanny Wing Generator World Energy Project, back in 2009. It was actually published. I talked about this, how the alternative energy industry, in fact, I have a chapter in that book. It is an addendum. It's called The Myth of Alternative Energy. And the whole point is that this myth was created that, well, we can, you know, by 2030, we will be 20% independent and we'll have green energy. It was all a myth. It was all a ruse. It was all a farce. It was all a planned package to put something on the market that they knew did not work, would flood the market, get all the subsidies. They would suck everything dry from all directions. Government subsidies, Green New Deal with trillions of dollars being thrown at it. And then after everybody is just sucked dry and realized that these things don't work, they're not going to work, they're not going to replace oil and coal, etc., then doggone it, then this well-orchestrated campaign rolls out, just like after 9/11, just like after every other false flag that you've seen, whether it's the pipeline shutting down or the Texas power outage, whatever it is, these are orchestrated, boys and girls, moms and dads, grandpas and grandmas. All of these things are orchestrated to bring out a final event that they control the energy. The last thing they want on this planet is a Mecani wing generator that actually works. And so, like, when you see publicity for something that floats out in the North Sea, costs millions of dollars, and it does not produce any electricity, and it gets a lot of fanfare, it gets a lot of publicity, it gets funding, it takes years to implement, and it doesn't work, that's all part of the program. I've always said, if you see it, if you see advertising and it gets funding, it doesn't work. It's guaranteed that it's just something that's going to chew up time. It's going to make some university professor some grant money, and a couple graduate students graduate saying that they worked on alternative energy. And the end result is, hey, nothing changes. That's the whole purpose of climate change. Okay, everybody that's running around jumping up and down, climate change. Do you know how much oil has stopped being used since they started jumping up and down saying climate change? None, like zero, nada, niche, nothing. All of the people jumping up and down have accomplished nothing. And production of dirty coal, it's at a maximum worldwide. The most horrific pollutant in the world, nuclear power, is not gone away. We could shut that down in a day. How about this? By just turning off a light bulb in the other room where you're not using it, we could shut down all the nuclear power plants in the United States today. They're talking about nuclear being green. Oh my goodness, it's the most horrific pollutant in the history of mankind. And they're saying, well, it doesn't pollute carbon dioxide. Talk about, you know, the circular logic or distorted logic that nuclear power is somehow green. Oh, my God. Boys and girls, it's the most horrific pollutant. One of those babies opens up, one cask of nuclear waste opening up would be enough to pollute the entire water supply of the entire United States, down in the Southwest or something like that. You know, and they want to put it at Yucca Mountain, whatever they call it. And, that's in the Southwest. All the wind blows across the entire United States. A meltdown there where that got into the atmosphere would pollute the entire United States. Yes, one cask. There you go. How about the Japanese dealing with Fukushima? No, nuclear power is not green. It ain't. Never was, never will be. I'm running out of time here. Got a few minutes left, a few seconds left. Go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. The water filter stuff still on sale, 10% off. MR5, get your own whole house water filter. The only thing like it on the planet that really does the job. Once again, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.